So we're very happy to have Daniel Schulze today from CERN. And Daniel has been working on particle colliders during his entire career. He has studied both circular and linear colliders as a member of several collaborations. And recently, he became one of the project leaders for the International Muon Collider Collaboration. So today, he's going to tell us about the prospects for the prospects and the challenges with the muon colliders. So please, whenever you're ready, feel free to
Yep.
start.
Okay. So thank you very much. So I will talk for the forming muon collider collaboration. Just for the context, maybe you all know, but I give it anyway. The muon collider has been studied mainly in the US within the MAP effort. And it has been reduced after the last P5 process. There were also activities in the UK and some at the INFN. Now, in Europe, this is therefore mainly something new. Before the European strategy, which concluded more than a year, well, a year ago, roughly, quite, there was a lab directors group, which is having the directors of the major labs in Europe, CERN, DESY, PSI, and so on. And they appointed a working group to look into the muon collider. So it was not a bottom-up thing at that moment, but it was like a review committee. And there was a favorable report from us, and then the strategy recommend R&D on muon beams, and the LDG, this lab directors group, sort of initiated the International Muon Collider Collaboration, and we had a kickoff meeting with 270 people last year. CERN is going to host the study, and we are currently finalizing the memorandum of cooperation, which initially was a memorandum of understanding, but then due to some legal issues with one of the members of CERN, we had to change that to memorandum of cooperation. Hopefully now all the legal terms are okay. You can guess which country that might be. So the goal of the International Muon Collider Collaboration, the objective is in time for the next European strategy update, which will be in about 5 years, the study aims to establish whether the investment into a full CDR and a demonstrator is scientifically justified. Scientifically, because we cannot say whether it should be done strategically, but whether scientifically that is justified. And a full CDR and a demonstrator we put because that's quite expensive. A full CDR typically means 20 million or so per year. And a demonstrator, if you want to build a facility, you typically have to spend 5 to 10% of the facility cost before you start. So we also talk about lots of money. At the time, I was estimating maybe half a billion. And for this aim, it will provide a baseline concept and some well-supported performance expectations with the key risks so that one can judge how likely the muon collider is. And it will also describe the demonstrator so that there is the R&D program in place with the cost of how much it will be. Obviously, this will be a report. And the focus is on 3 TB and 10+ TB. The 3 TB is more available technologies now, and the 10+ with more advanced technologies. And we will look at the synergy with other options, neutrino factory like NEWSTORM or so, and the Higgs factory. The Higgs factory we didn't put in for political reasons, and also there are mature proposals now. But if nobody moves ahead with the Higgs factory, I would have to reconsider doing a Higgs factory with muon collider, and we will define the R&D path. So this is the potential long-term timeline, which is technically limited. Means if you get all the resources you want, if nothing goes wrong, and we would have first 2 years of exploratory phase, 3 years of definition phase. So first we, it's more open and then it converges more. We would do a baseline design, start designing a test facility and design some models of hardware that we need. Similar for the detector, but I think there is mainly the physics potential that needs to be looked at. And then the next European strategy, I mean, we should be ready to decide on the test facility. After that process, the European strategy can then endorse that. And we would actually do a design optimization, construct and use the test facility and the prototypes and test them. And then after a total of 11 years, we would be ready to commit, you know, the cost of the project with some uncertainty, but still well enough. So you could know that this is the next project that should be built. You go for a TDR, about 4 years, I would guess, and you start the approval procedure. So you're ready to construct in 15 years from now. Why that? I will not tell you about that. You know better than me. Lepton physics at high energies is very interesting because it's having high, I mean, it has high precision, and it has a discovery reach. So it combines the abilities of a hadron and a low energy lepton machine in one. And we think that a 14 TeV lepton collider is equivalent to 100 to 200 TeV hadron collider. Now it depends on what you are looking at. And like with the Z0, we had discussions, the direct reach is somewhat less than for a hadron collider in that case, but the indirect reach of a Z prime would be enormously larger because already click 3 TeV could do the same as FCCHH, I think. The luminosity goal is driven by the fact that the cross-section goes down with this square of center of mass energy. And so you see what we require at 10 TeV would be 2 10 to the 35. Okay. Now, looking at what has been proposed in Europe, these are all the lepton colliders with their center of mass energy and the luminosity. And you see we have the circular colliders and they drop dramatically in luminosity with energy. So it's 365 for the FCC-EE, the highest. And they're already backed off from 380 that we had for click as the initial state, just because any GV counts. And then there are linear colliders, and you see the highest energy proposes click at 3 TeV, which would be in three stages. Now, if you look at that, the cost estimate is 18 giga Swiss francs for all three stages together. Each of them is roughly 6 billion. Actually, the second one here is a bit more expensive. The total power consumption is almost 600 megawatts. So if you compare it to FCCHH, it's 24 giga Swiss francs and also about 600 megawatts. So this seems to be indeed a practical limit for political reasons going on three stages there. But the FCCHH in one stage, it would certainly be more difficult here. You at least can share over a longer time. Now, the energy limit, we'll not say very much. Just obviously in the ring, you have the advantage of having multipass, but the disadvantage for leptons of electrons radiating synchrotron radiation. And you mitigate that by actually colliding protons. I mean, that's the only reason why we collide protons, not because they are any nicer to collide, I think, but because they have less synchrotron radiation. With linear colliders, you avoid that, but you go into another challenge, which is the single pass. And it has two consequences. The energy, you need the full voltage because you accelerate in a straight way in one go. And you also collide only once. So you need to squeeze your beam to extremely small spot sizes, which is very exciting and very interesting to work on, but certainly challenging. Now, let's look at the cost. And I just took click as an example, because in principle, you can extend click to higher energies. At 3 TeV, it's 18 gigaswiss francs. You look at the upgrade cost from 1.5 to 3 TeV, which was about 8 gigaswiss francs. And then you just scale linearly to 14 TeV, and you see that's 59 gigaswiss francs for the upgrade. And then because of mass production, maybe it can be a little less, so 40 to 50 gigaswiss francs. So it's an order of magnitude above what we would consider reasonable for the next project right now. Okay, plasma technology might make that cheaper. To be seen, there is no design yet that you can have any reliable cost estimate about. But there are other issues also. So for the linear collider, and laser power, for example, is not cheap. I mean, so the claim of a lower cost is just maybe. The luminosity of a linear collider per beam power is a constant. So here, this is just the formula, luminosity is proportional to the charge divided by the beta function, which is the focusing property of the beam quality, the emittance in both planes, and then the power of the beam. So independent of energy. And that means as you go up in energy, you need to spend more and more power. You go with the square of energy to have your luminosity scale with the square of energy. Okay. And in reality, this is even worse because you already start losing at higher energies due to more emittance degradation because your machine becomes longer. And you start to have synchrotron radiation in the focusing systems of your beam. Just the fact that beam is not zero size, but has a little size means that you get significant effects of synchrotron radiation, which deteriorate luminosity by about a factor two in the case of click at 3 TeV. So, but at the best, luminosity is independent of beam power. And then you just calculate for click, it's 300 megawatts of power from the grid going into the beam to produce 28 megawatts of beam power. Then you scale to 14 TeV and you find you need 600 megawatts of beam power. And that means you need about 6 gigawatts of wall plug power from the grid, plus a little bit for the infrastructure. The magnets and so are not included in this. So huge power consumption. I don't think we can afford it in the future. So the muon collider idea, as you are certainly aware of, is yes, why not use a heavier lepton? So you reduce synchrotron radiation and everything is fine, which is true, but the lifetime is only 2.2 microseconds at rest. And that fact drives the design in several ways. It means we need to rapidly accelerate to not lose the muons. And if we can only collide for a limited number of times, so we also have to do that. And then we have all of these muon decay in the machine. So they produce an electron or a positron and two neutrinos, and they generate a mass. And we have to deal with that. That also drives the design. And this is how such a concept looks like. It's a concept, so it's not to scale, by far not to scale. You first need a proton beam, very intense, so you need to combine different proton bunches to get a very intense proton bunch. You shoot it into a target, produce lots of pions, and these pions you let fly, and then they decay, and so there are muons produced, and you bunch the muons into a single bunch, rotate that, that's a detail, and then you start cooling the beam, because it comes from a scattering process. You need to improve the beam quality, so you cool it, which means you reduce the emittance, which is like the temperature of the beam. And you do that in a few stages. I'll show maybe some detail later. And then you have to accelerate it rapidly, first in a LINAC to be fastest, then in a recirculating LINAC, and then in a big ring in a few turns. And then you inject it into a collider ring, which stays always at the same energy, so it doesn't ramp like the LHC, because you couldn't ramp rapidly enough in a superconducting magnet, and where you collide. And you certainly try to make that as small as possible. What we saw in the map design is that there was no CDR and not a coherent baseline of the machine. So many of the things had been studied, but like individually, and there was not something that was totally consistent across, and no cost estimate and no power estimate that is fully reliable. But it looked quite good, and we didn't see anything that doesn't work. We saw many things that are extremely challenging, but that's our job in the end. So this is showing you the luminosity per mean power for the map parameters and for click. You see click has this constant and it goes a bit down at 3 TeV due to these radiation effects, which will grow more and more. And this is the muon collider. And you see that actually it increases linearly with energy, the power, the luminosity per power. Great, that's the reason why we want it.
Yeah, Daniel, can I ask you something? You may mention it later. If you do, just tell me and I'll wait. So, how long does it take? Do you need to build a new beam dam to produce these muons? Because you would lose a lot in the cooling process. How long does it take to go from the beam?
So you produce 10 times more muons than you actually collide.
I see. So you lose a factor of 10 of the muons during the cooling process.
Yeah. That's the budget. Mm-hmm.
And that has been demonstrated? That sounds like quite, I mean, it's a great, just a factor of 10 is like great.
Yeah. No, I come back to that. Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank
it's
you.
A good question. So indeed, you need to accelerate rapidly, and the cooling is very, very difficult because it has to be done rapidly. But let's first look at the luminosity goals. So actually,
sorry, Daniel, are you also going to explain why the luminosity increases with energy?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
Yeah, in a moment. So sorry for that. Because this is, it looks hard, and then you have to justify why we go that road anyway, because we think it's the best road, even if it's hard. Okay, so we go from 1 inverse Artaban at 3 TeV to 20 inverse Artaban at 14, and the scales, as it should be 0.9 here, but we prefer the round number. And these are the beam parameters associated with getting these integrated luminosities within 5 years in a single detector. I don't know if you can afford 2 detectors. We normally should, but as I will come back later, radiation issues might make it hard. So that's to be studied. And it may be that we should run more than 5 years, because 5 years is really short for such an expensive machine. The FCC HH takes 25 years to accumulate luminosity. Okay. And here you can already see 20 megawatts of beam power at 14 TeV as compared to 28 for click. So less than the 3 TeV click to get full luminosity at 14 TeV. Why is that? So the simplistic Well, it's very simple. You see, the bunch charge is almost the same, except that you lose roughly 20% when you go from 3 TeV to 10 or 14 TeV, just because they decay. You operate at 5 Hertz. This is your beam power. The size of the ring, you see it scales roughly linearly with energy. This here is a bit larger because it's less ambitious technology. And now, this here is the longitudinal emittance of the beam. It's the temperature in the longitudinal dimension, the phase space side. And it's a constant. It's given an energy times length. And now in the collider ring, we can afford a certain spread in this energy. And that spread is always a fraction of the energy of the particle. So it's 1 per mil. And that means that for the same product of length times energy spread in absolute units, the bunch can actually become shorter and shorter as we go up in energy. It goes as 1/energy. It's 5 times longer at 3 TeV than at 14 TeV. Well, it's almost 5 times. And that means, because the bunch becomes shorter, that we can squeeze it more, because the region over which it needs to be small, it becomes shorter and shorter. And therefore, this beta function affects the transfer side, but also how long the waist is. And unfortunately, did not include a plot on that. I should have. So we can squeeze the beam more at higher energies, which is unusual. And that means the beam size goes down proportional, is 1/energy. And the luminosity is proportional to 1/that squared. And the power goes up linearly with energy because of the same number of particles. So you end up indeed getting more luminosity per beam power at higher energies. And this is the formula here. And this is written on the in a little larger font. So the luminosity is proportional, as we said, to the energy, which comes from the fact that you can squeeze it more, times the energy acceptance of your ring, relative energy acceptance. So that's this one here. And then it is proportional to the field of your collider ring. The higher the field, the smaller the ring, the more collisions you get in the same time. And the muons have a given lifetime. So higher magnetic field, average around ring is important. That's the magnet challenge. This here is the brightness of the beam. So it's the charge divided by its phase space. And so the more charge we put in the phase space, or the smaller we make the phase space, the likelier we get a collision. And then there's this final part, which is the rep rate times the charge times the energy. And so this is the current, the power of the beam. So this is what we pay for in terms of power bill. So you see, we want still to have that high. We want a very bright beam, a good lattice in the collider ring. We want very strong magnets, and then we profit from the high energy for free.
Sorry, but I don't understand. Why is this argument specific to muon colliders and not to any lepton colliders?
Because in click, this beta function does not change with energy. You cannot make the beta function smaller with energy because the bunch remains the same. You're already at the limit of what you can do. So that is very specific.
But is there an intuitive way of understanding that?
Yes, in click, the bunch length does not change with energy, but because you accelerate in UR, so you have to keep it the same for fundamental reasons of the acceleration process. So to not increase the energy spread in the beam, you need a certain length of the bunch. And so even at higher energies, you need to maintain that length. And that means that you cannot focus the beam more. And actually, we are at the limit of the focusing system in any case. Even if the bunch were shorter, we couldn't focus more because we didn't find a design that can focus better than what we did.
But that's because of the acceleration process. But that means just that the muon, the acceleration process at the muon collider will be different than at click. But then why would
in the muon collider, we think we can squeeze the beta function more because we start with a much larger value than in click. Because in the muon collider, you assume that you can make the bunches shorter as you go up in energy because you preserve the longitudinal phase space of your bunch. And you then just rotate it. So you squeeze it. It becomes shorter but wider in energy spread. And that you can accept as you go up in energy.
Okay.
So sorry, that would be nicely fitting into some accelerator.
Yeah, no, sorry for that. It's just...
it's a good question. I should prepare once a slide for that to explain it because it might come up more often.
Yeah, is it correct to say that you also profit from the fact that you can store the bunches? Yeah? So because yeah. naively one could say, okay, you still have some limit, you know, on squeezing the muon bunches even there. So why it is, but I mean, the limit is smaller than for electrons. But I think you just can say that you put more bunches. You put a lot of bunches in the ring. That's the thing.
You put one bunch into the ring only, but you get more collisions. And the fact that you get more collisions is described here. The fact that the higher your field, the more collisions you get.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So in a linear collider, this doesn't matter because it's one in any case. And here, I mean, it's a proportionality that there is some factor that you can calculate how it depends on the B, on the field.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but so why
you get 1,500 collisions?
Yeah, but yeah. Why you can put only a single bunch? You will say it later, or yeah, because why you cannot put more?
You only need a single bunch.
Oh, okay.
I can come back to that in a second.
Okay.
So the physics potential, so what are the key topics that we need to address? Physics potential. We need a solid physics case and people agreeing on the relative merits compared to other projects. This is, and it seems there are new things that people start thinking about with muons that they didn't think about before, and which they also didn't think about, I mean, with click at 3TV, because, okay. So this really needs to be worked out. There is some problem with the environment. I come back to that, which is called neutrino radiation, and that might impact the site and our energy reach. There's some beam-induced background in the detector, which current studies seem to indicate that is maybe okay, but further studies need to be done. We need to look at the high-energy systems because they limit our energy reach due to cost and power consumption, and then at the quality of the beam at production, which is the production itself and the cooling. So this is another view of the muon collider. Here you see this is the injector complex, not to scale, but it's much smaller, the collider ring, and then actually the iterator ring, which is larger, and actually it's typically larger than it's indicated here. Okay, and you see, so this here is the quality of the beam, this here is the cost, and the collider ring would be roughly 1 kilometer circumference per TV center of mass. And this could be like a 30 kilometer ring, say for the 10 or 14 TV collider. Okay, just to give you a scale. So it's still shorter than click. I mean, the click is 50 kilometers at 3 TV. This is somewhat similar maybe, but at 14 TV. So what are the challenges? The first is the source. You need to send a proton beam into a target, and that is 1.3 megawatts of protons going into the target. And you need to capture the particles, so you need a very strong solenoid around that. So you have a superconducting solenoid and the copper solenoid on the inside. This here. And by that, you get a very high field, and you have to protect these magnets from radiation. So this is one of the design challenges. But people think 1.3 megawatts is possible, and actually targets of about a megawatt have been done. So there was a test with liquid mercury in the past at CERN. You see the jet here, hit by the proton beam, and explodes slowly enough that it doesn't matter, and recovers quickly enough that it's ready for the next shot. But we think liquid mercury might not be allowed for safety reasons anymore. But it looks good. And so the main problem would be the radiation in the solenoid, but should be handleable. Okay. Then there's the cooling. And this is now the part which is indeed different because you don't have time. You cannot damp in a ring like you would normally do the beam. Also, you don't have synchrotron radiation, so it doesn't work so well. So what you do is you cool in matter. So what you have here is you have absorbers. And if you go through the absorber, you see your particle, so it has a longitudinal momentum and a transverse momentum. It goes like that. And because you lose energy in the absorber material, you lose momentum in the transverse and longitudinal. And then you accelerate. So in these parts here, you accelerate. And so you only replace longitudinal momentum. So you end up with a less transverse momentum after reacceleration. And that makes the beam cooler and cooler. And what you need for that, the ingredients are very high gradients in these cavities to limit their length, not to lose too many muons. But you need a very strong solenoid field around the target and then naturally around the accelerating cavity, because the stronger the solenoid, the smaller the beam phase space will be. And this is because you have a negative effect, which is multiple scattering. So you have the cooling, this process here, which is given there. And then you have multiple scattering, and that the effect of that depends on the beta function, this is not the easy, relativistic beta of the beam, and that beta function becomes smaller if you have strong solenoids. It's just proportional to 1 over the field. So in order to minimize the emittance growth you have here, you need to minimize the beta function. And that means you have the solenoid, and then you have to put the X-rating cavities into a strong magnetic field, which you don't like to do because they don't like that typically. They normally don't get high fields, X-rating fields. So here you see what needs to be done. You start with the beam, and you have the phase space in horizontal and in longitudinal direction. And you start at the target with a very hot beam. And then you do the phase rotator trick and somewhat cooler. And then you do this cooling, as I mentioned. And it works in both planes. I will not show you the detail, but you can do a trick to have it in longitudinal transfers. And then after some time, you now take 6 of the bunches here that you have produced and put them together. So your phase space has to increase, but you get more particles in your bunch. And then you cool further. And then at some point, you run away and you cool just in transfers and let the longitudinal grow because that's advantageous. And so you end up here. And so this is how this looks like in these systems. Now, there have been simulations showing that you are overachieving in all the first part. And then with the latest designs, you underachieve somewhat in the final stage. This is roughly a factor 2. Not a disaster, but not so nice. And one thinks that the better technology as actually exists. So the proven technology is better than the one used in the calculation. And with some additional tricks, this should be possible to move to the target.
Sorry.
But you cannot reduce the emittance very much anymore. And because it is still relatively large, you need many particles in the bunch to have your phase space density, because it's the density you care about. That's why you have only single bunches which have a high charge and are somewhat fat, but the density is very good. So what are the challenges? As I said, there are the cavities in the strong magnetic field. And actually, here you see a test where.
So Daniel, can I ask you something on this plot? So here you say this has been achieved. You mean you have done experiments with a target number of particles? So when you say initial, that you say that you have, this is simulation.
These are simulations here.
Okay.
Yeah, no. But the hardware, what I was saying is that the hardware actually achieved better performances than assumed in the simulation.
I see.
The simulation.
What is simulation here? This is the confusing part because you say achieved simulations, but I don't understand.
So this is what has been achieved in simulation, but with hardware assumptions that are more conservative than reality.
I see.
This can now be improved by improving the design.
Does that also include the final? Because I would imagine that. So the target being the LINAC that you will use to produce the original muon, does this process change depending on how many muons you have in the band in the you want to cool?
No, not until you go over a certain amount.
And we
stay under that amount, and that is the reason. If you get to the same phase space,
yeah.
But if you have more muons, you get a higher density. And so you push until your density is so high that you start to get these effects that would make your final emittance larger. Once the particles start to interact significantly, then you stop. That's really like how the parameters have been made.
I see. And this is done based on, so there is already, you're saying their hardware is already there to do this.
Yeah. As I'm showing here,
like
these type of cavities have been proven. As single cavities. There have been solenoids with more than 30 Tesla demonstrated with some aperture that is similar to the aperture that is needed. And then there has been an integrated test in the UK. This is mice.
Okay.
So these are components and they're better than what has been used in the simulation. And this is the integrated experiment. Now mice certainly did do somewhat less due to financial constraints. Mm-hmm. And I shall not comment on. We would prefer to do a better demonstration with less financial constraints and also maybe at CERN in the long run, let's see. So what you did there is you have a muon beam And then you actually have the absorber for the cooling. And they planned to also add cavities. And then financially, that wasn't possible because there were some problems with the magnets, which then were costly to fix. And they had, I think, not seen the fact that hydrogen in high pressure actually creates a safety risk that needs to be mitigated and costs money. I mean, many things cost lots of money. But what they did do is they just looked at the principle. So you send the muon beam through this target, and then you compare the calculated change of phase space with the actual measured one. Mm-hmm. And here you can see what happens. So this is, if you don't have an absorber here, then you get, you start with these muons here, and you get after the place of the absorber, you get the green distribution. Okay, and obviously muons at higher amplitudes you lose because they just get lost. Now you put in your absorber, and what happens is the following. An initial distribution doesn't change, but your final distribution, okay, still at larger amplitudes, these particles cannot survive. But you see that you have more particles suddenly in the beam, at lower amplitudes than you had before, and than you have in the initial beam. And so what happened is that particles that were here, in the initial part of the beam here, after the absorber, they have migrated down to smaller amplitudes.
Sorry, what's the amplitude here?
The amplitude here is the amplitude of the particle at some measurement plane. So it's a measure of the emittance. It's a measure of the phase space.
Okay. So lower amplitude is good because it's more...
Exactly.
Cool. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. So the phase space density then describes the ensemble. And this is like measuring the individual muons because they didn't have so many muons on top. So it was a very tricky experiment.
I see. But this doesn't seem like a gigantic change in the...
No, it's like a 10% right? change in emittance. But that is what you get with single absorber and that setup. No re-acceleration. So it's a proof of principle, has been published in Nature, but it's not, I mean, we would like to have a few cells with re-acceleration.
So how long will be the total final setup? Because you only have like, so this, you only have 100 meters or something before the muon decays, right? So
you have 660 meters okay. And, at rest.
Yeah. I
mean, well, the equivalent in time, if you take the 2.2 microseconds. So it's a few hundred meters long. So you indeed lose a good fraction of the muons, but you keep enough for afterwards.
That's what simulations show. That is, so the whole thing you will like measure 100 will be 100 meters long. This whole array of like material plus cavity.
It's somewhat longer, but exactly. And there is a bit of reserve in the design. So I mean, the factor 10 is to have an envelope, not to exactly design to that. But this is why the RF gradient, for example, needs to be so high, because you can make it short. And now the gradient is higher than what we thought it would be, so you can make the thing even more compact. But you make it as compact as possible, so you lose as few muons as possible.
Can I ask another question? It's actually not related to cooling, to the first step, so the production. I heard that there was an idea of producing these muons by shooting some positrons on a target.
I come to that at the very end.
Oh, okay. Thanks.
It was an exciting idea, but I'm worried that it doesn't work. Okay. So as I said now.
Your current estimates don't include any fancy new technology for how you produce the beam, right? So the things that you are talking about now don't assume any new huge extrapolation about technological upgrades for them.
No, exactly. Like the magnets in this design that I presented, they have been using commercial magnet quality. So something that you could order from industry directly as it is. And only the magnets at the very end, these ones here, where you need a very few there, we talk about a handful, those are beyond what is typically possible. And there they are pushing the technology. So. And that's why this one was designed, because that's relevant. And there we have actually set up an R&D request with the German ministry to do even better magnets. And in the US, there is an important effort to do even better magnets. But with the design, it's within a factor two. So I mean, it's not going to break it if it cannot improve, but we should be able to improve. After we have the muon beam and after it's cool, we now have to accelerate it rapidly so that we don't lose it again. And first we use a LINAC for that, then the recirculating LINAC. This is just the best to have a LINAC, but then it's more cost effective to go through the LINAC a few times, but and then you go to the ring, and then it's even more cost effective, but a little less good than the LINAC. So it's a compromise as you go up. And the higher the energy, the more time you gain. I mean, it's probably, and then you inject into the collider ring. And all of the cost of the project, I mean, the most of the cost is in this acceleration complex, especially in this ring, and in the collider ring.
Like now, can I ask you something very, this is, if you're in ignorance, very naive about the acceleration stage also. So the acceleration at the LHA is just some RF cavity or something, but it takes a long time to accelerate the particles to their 14 dBs or something. So here will be the same?
No, here it's going to talk about 100 turns. So here it's done in milliseconds. For a 3 dB, it would be done in 5 milliseconds.
5 milliseconds, but you will lose lots of muons then.
Yeah.
So that's just how it works. You just create a... Okay.
This actually is one of the challenges. I come back next slide or so.
Oh, next slide, sorry.
No, it's a good question. In the LHC, ramping up the energy takes 20 minutes and the magnets are very slow. So now how can you do this acceleration here? There are two ways. You can either use a rapid cycling synchrotron. So you can use a ring where the magnets follow the beam energy, but you have to do it in milliseconds. And so you cannot do that with superconducting magnets, conventional superconducting magnets. They take many minutes. So what you could do is you could use fast ramping normal magnets, normal conducting magnets. And that can be done. The problem is then you get only 2 Tesla field, not 14 or so. Okay. And then you can use a trick. You can mix superconducting magnets and normal magnets. And you actually power the normal magnets against the superconducting ones initially. So they cancel almost the superconducting field. You inject the beam. You see here, this is the average field. And then you ramp these normal magnets down and up on the other side. So they add. And by that, you basically double their swing. So they give you twice the leverage because first you subtract from something, then you add. Okay, and by that you half the number of normal magnets that you need. So that's option one, but you need the fast pulsing magnets. The option two is you design a magnet, lattice with magnets that can accept actually very large differences in beam energy. A factor 2 or 3 can be done. There has been a proof of principle with the MR ring at Rutherford, and so it can be done. That was also a Nature publication. But then it's a challenging lattice design. It's a challenging magnet design and challenging beam dynamics also. But these are the two options, a fixed lattice with very high field magnets, special ones, and then this fast pulsing magnets. Now let's look at the fast pulsing magnets. What does it mean? If you mix it with superconducting ones, you need about 5 kilometers of these 2 Tesla magnets per TV of beam energy. And you see here, there's a parameter table for acceleration 1.3 to 1.5 TV for the beam energy here. And so you need about 6 kilometers of fast ramping magnets for that. Okay, and you go from -2 to 2. And you'll need about 2 kilometers of normal superconducting magnets. Okay, that's very fine. Now, what can you do to improve that? What you can do to improve, I mean, for the 3 TB, you don't need to improve because it's only 14 kilometers. So if you go to the LHC, you see that we would only need a swing from -1 to 1, or we could just not have any superconducting magnets and just ramp up our magnets to 1.7 Tesla. So easy. If it's cost effective, you could use the LHC tunnel for the 3 TB and even more, no problem. Now, what are the challenges? Obviously, the fast ramping normal magnet is challenging, but people think it's feasible. And then there is a problem that you need to extract the magnetic energy from the magnet after the pulse and need to store it, because if you lose it, it's about 200 megajoule. I mean, you cannot lose that 5 times a second. That's already a gigawatt. So what you have to do is you have to store that. And that means power converters, which are unique and very challenging to recover the energy. Okay, so this is being looked at now at CERN, and they gave a cost estimate for the capacitors, which is only 30 million, but the design is not, there may be some other hiccups, but it's fairly cheap. And the other option that you could have is actually that you use HTS magnets, because they could ramp very fast. High field, high temperature superconductors can ramp faster because they're more robust. But those need to be developed. So there was actually a first go where they ramped magnets with 12 Tesla per second, up to a bit more than half a Tesla. But we still need to improve that by about a factor 40 in speed, and the field by a factor of a few. But this is a first go, so we hope that maybe HTS magnets could be used. And then the acceleration of the beam is challenging because we need in 100 turns to put the full energy into the bunches. So we are looking into that to understand that there's no cost limitation and no excessive power use. But like this HTS magnet, it's quite impressive, and there's interest in Italy to do better ones, faster ones. Okay. Now, looking into the collidering, we want the highest fields, have the smallest ring. And you see it was about 10 kilometers per TV at high energies. We have the problem that all the muons, when they decay, they produce electrons and positrons. And the total power of that is about 500 watts per meter. So what we cannot allow is that they're getting lost in the magnet, because the magnet would quench, become normal conducting, and not keep the field. And also over long term, this would be a radiation problem. So what we have to do is we have to make the magnet big and put shielding inside with tungsten, and by that protect the magnet. So that needs to be designed. There have been at lower energies calculations, and it's possible, but something that has to be carefully studied. And then we need to focus the beam at the IP, and we need to focus more and more at higher energies. And the problem is, if we have a smaller and smaller focus, then the beam becomes larger and larger around the interaction region. It becomes more and more difficult to focus it. So this magnet system also needs to be studied in detail to verify that it can be done at 10 and 14 TV, still with the quality that we need. There we actually saw lots of progress in the past years, mainly driven by developments for FCC, but also for other projects. So there's a consortium looking at improved cables, and like at Fermilab, their 15 Tesla dipole demonstrator with a significant aperture had been developed and tested. So there the technology is progressing, and that makes us hopeful that this technology then can be used for the muon collider indeed. For the high energies, we would need something like niobium-310 or even HTS if possible. Okay. Now, the one problem that you might have heard of, which is very annoying, is neutrino radiation. And a very simple thing, when your muon decays, you produce two neutrinos, one muon and one electron neutrino or antineutrino, depending on combination. And they go into a very, very small cone. The opening angle is about 1/γ. So at 14 TV, it's less than 14 microradian, because it's actually even less than 1/γ. And now you come out of the surface of the Earth at some point, and the likelihood of the neutrino scattering is small, but it's not zero. So you can produce showers just before you leave the surface or just after. And these showers produce some radiation, and that radiation should not exceed the natural background field, because otherwise it's not nice for the public. Now, in direction of straight, this is certainly the worst, because you have many neutrinos that go in exactly the same direction. So what you will have to do, I think, is to buy the land here and on that side, and you put some nice neutrino experiment there. So that is a civil engineering question that we will have to face. Where could we put that? Now, for the arcs, it's more difficult, because you could put yourself on a mountain or on an island, but you would like to put it next to CERN. So I don't know, to be seen. Now here you see actually there's a formula for how much radiation you get. We'll not go into that very much, except that you see again that having a high phase space density, this is 1/phase space density, is helpful. You get less radiation per integrated luminosity. And higher, stronger fields in the magnets, this is the magnetic field, is also better. Okay, now what is the legal limit? And that is typically 1 millisievert per year to the public. Normally, then you have to check that nobody else is producing something. And I don't think you want to go around and tell people that you go to the limit of what you're entitled to. it's still somewhat less than you naturally get. In Switzerland, you get from Radon, you get something like three times that, but still. So the MAP study had a goal of 0.1 millisievert per year. Now, if you go below 10 microsievert, then actually you go out of the range where you need sort of the legal procedures, and you become a negligible source of radiation. And it's similar to the LHC, which sort of stays below about 5 microsievert or so per year to the public. So based on that, we are aiming for something in this order. And we want to bring it to a level as low as reasonably possible. ALARA, I mean, that's just what you have to do, similar to the LHC. So more ambitious than the MAP.
Oh, hey, Daniel?
Yeah?
So does this hotspot refer to when the muon just entered the ring?
As in this like, is, you know, no, this is in the moment when they decay. So they circulate and they die. And always when they die, they produce two neutrinos and they go in a small arc. So you have a disk.
But it's not like there's one hot spot, right?
There is one hot spot where we have the strait. So here would be the experiment. So here there would be the experiment in the center, probably. And then you would go straight, and there you have more of a problem. And you would also inject into this area, exactly.
Okay.
And that you have to mitigate by closing this site.
All right.
But here for the arc, the radiation is naturally in that range if you design the ring properly, but you don't want it that high. You want it significantly lower. So I made a calculation with 500 meter depth and so on, 14 TV, you stay below that, but not below this, if you don't do something. So we became ambitious and so sort of built on an idea of Fermilab people, but they said, why don't you move the beam a little bit in the aperture? So you change the angle slightly. Now, I have to admit, I didn't understand their scheme, and I'm not 100% sure it works for the arcs. Could be just me not understanding what they said, but I think it seemed okay. But what we plan to do is to actually change this angle dramatically. So if you look at a single spot, the angle would really move sort of in straight lines because you want to distribute equally over a large angle. And this would be plus minus 1 milliradian, say. That can be achieved by actually using 1% of the main field in the bending, in the vertical bending. So it's small compared to the main bending field. It's okay. Would have the 1 milliradian, and you would get a sort of a shape of the beamline like this with an amplitude of 15 centimeters peak to peak. Now this has to be changed with time because you want at each point, the radiation that goes to one location is given over a few centimeters. So you have to change after some time. You need to have a second configuration where the angle at this very location has changed from zero to something. Mm-hmm. So you have to move your beamline, but you can do it slowly because the integration time, the official one, is 1 year. You probably have to do it a little more quickly. I mean, you have to do going through all angles in more, I mean, maybe every month. So that way, I don't know, that we have to work out with there's no legal requirement like this. It's over 1 year, but we would probably want to do better than that.
Yeah, but besides that, what about effect on the on the detectors? I mean, does that...
In the straits, we don't... No, we close it before the straits. So the detectors are not going to see it.
Okay, so it doesn't affect at all the detector. Okay.
So now what I should say, this is the idea. It would allow us to be comparable to LHC with a tunnel of only 200 meter deep. So 14 TV. So it looks like that could be the solution. But there is indeed a question, what does the beam think about this? That we are going to study. What about little things like, for example, you have all the cooling fluids attached to your magnets, and now you move the magnets. So all the cooling lines have to somehow accommodate for that. So there's a little bit of thinking required, but fundamentally this could be the solution that achieves, I mean, this is the single most difficult problem. If the radiation is too high, if the public doesn't like it, it will not happen, the project. So this is dramatic. It is ambitious. It reminds me of the click alignment where we said we have to decouple the machine from the natural motion of the ground And we have to put everything on movers to be able to move it within a few microns over the full length. And then over many years of design, actually we achieved exactly this, improved these systems to work as expected. So here we might need something similar. I mean, and we are actually working with the same team now. Let's see how many people they can put on that to look into that. But it would solve the problem of being, I mean, you could cite it in the Geneva area if that works. Okay. So very quickly, for the detector, in case you're interested, we have tentative performance specifications. That was a little effort to get that. You can actually look that up. Here we have a web page, and there is, you can find it. And now we try, so this is for theorists to have some realistic degradation due to detector. And then the detector study should prove that this is what you achieve, including the background. And so there is some studies to look at the detector background. And the main sort of approach here was to use 1.5 TV because we had a lattice and the design, and we are now going to do them for higher energies. But people just started sort of formally this year at CERN, so a few weeks ago. And so this is like the click detector with a few modifications. And one of the modifications is that there are these nozzles inside of the detector, which stop all of the positrons and electrons which come from the decaying muons and could rush into the detector. And so they stop them from doing that. And then you have certainly secondaries that are produced here and that leak out in the vertex detector and that you have to deal with. Some people said, oh, this is bad. And then like our dear colleagues from the LHC looked at that, from the LHC detectors, and they said, oh God, that's boring. So the truth might be somewhere in the middle. And we have to see how it scales to high energies still. But okay, it could be just fine. And this is all done in detailed simulations. A quick remark on any positron-based scheme. I love that when I looked at it when we started the review. So the idea is the following. You use positrons at about 45 GeV, send them into a target. And because then the center of mass energy of the positron with the electrons in the target is above twice the muon mass, you start to produce muon pairs. And then you like circulate your positrons and you actually collect muons from the target and circulate them through the target again. And then you have a second bunch going into the target at the same time. So you produce more muons. And so you increase the intensity of the muons turn by turn. And after about a millisecond, which is the lifetime roughly of the muons and this energy, you would extract. You have accumulated like maybe 2000 of these. Perfect. And you can produce smaller emittance muon beams for that. So it's great. However, there is a number of, so in the original scheme, there were two flaws. One was they miscalculated the emittance that they get from multiple scattering. That you can, for the ideal case, you can do it on a piece of paper. And so I found that it was off by more than an order of magnitude. And then they actually assumed you can combine bunches in the collider ring, but they combined them by mistake in the same phase space. And that you cannot do. You cannot put particles in the same phase space, except with this trick of doing it in matter with the production. That's some fundamental Lewis theory. I mean, so phase space density cannot change. That's Hamilton, I mean, fundamental mechanics. So therefore, they lost about 3 orders of magnitude in luminosity. And now I think that we didn't see any parameters for the moment that could recover from there. And one of the reasons is that in this target, you also have Bremsstrahlung. And so you need about 10 to the 5 positrons, which all emit Bremsstrahlung, get lost afterwards, to actually have one which produces a muon pair. And so the total energy that you need to produce a muon pair is of the order of 1 millijoule. It's almost like a measurable quantity, I mean, almost microscopic. And therefore, you can have only very few muons. And then it's very difficult to get a phase-based density because it's very difficult to get a significant charge with this scheme. Small emittances, yes, but charge. So, okay, we didn't find a good solution. And I tried to do that very systematically. And okay. I'm very worried that it doesn't work. It's too bad because it was such a nice scheme. We could have used plasma acceleration here. I was really enthusiastic about that because it could have been cheap and strong. It was the ideal beam for plasma acceleration because it was much less quality demanding than a linear collider beam. It was much, much, much more relaxed. 5 orders of magnitude, more robust. Okay.
But I guess I mean, okay, so the emittance they calculated, they miscalculated, that's fine. But the luminosity, that just depends on how many electrons you can choose on your target, and you can shoot on your target, right? So that did they mess up that too, or
is... Yeah, so what you need, so I did a calculation, which I discussed with Pantaleo, and you would need to have at least 100 bunches of 10 to the 15 positrons that you shoot into the target to produce a dense enough muon beam to get some reasonable luminosity. I don't have the slides here on my fingertips, I'm afraid, to show you the calculation. So you need basically to accumulate the muons over 200. So you get a certain rate because you know how much energy you spend per muon pair. Then you can say, maybe I can afford 100 megawatts of positrons being lost to have a reasonable power consumption. You don't worry even if the target can survive that. It cannot. But if it could, if you ignore the target, survive it. Just you get so and so many muons per second that you are entitled to produce with a reasonable power consumption. On technicalities side, it's just cross-sections, Bremsstrahlung versus muon pair production. So fundamental cross-sections. Then how many, and then you get a certain limit. And then how many muons do you need? And you would need the muons over 200 seconds, all accumulated. And they don't live so long. So you would actually need to store the energy for 200 seconds, fill all the power into some device, and then release it in one shot. And that doesn't seem possible. And actually, the target, I don't think, can stand these bunches. And we cannot have 10 to the 15 positrons per bunch. We hate each other too much. They repulse each other too much. So there is no credible scheme for the moment that leads to a reasonable luminosity. Maybe somebody can come up with a clever idea, some young person with a fresh brain, but we didn't have that great idea yet. So we don't have a parameter set that looks reasonable for the moment. It's bad. It's very unfortunate because I love that scheme and so now what is going on? It's a little bit of formalities to show you that things are still running. So there's the European roadmap on X-ray to R&D, which for the younger ones of you, maybe, I don't know how it's in a kind of, but I didn't like it. It was not so interested in the financial aspects and the formal aspects at the time when I was younger, but well, one gets used to that matters. So this LDG has been charged by Council, which is representing the European member states, to deliver an accelerated R&D roadmap by the end of this year. So this is a request to define what should be done. But actually, they should make proposals and scenarios, and then Council decides what to do. That was very explicit in the mandate. So the LDG will deliver a report to Council, and it's the extended LDG because they institute the panels for that. So they will report to Council, not to the CERN management or so, but to the highest body, and they will report the scientific drivers for the R&D, the progress needed, current state of the art, and they will also deliver what deliverables could be for the future and what the demonstrators one can envisage in the next decade. And then a prioritized work plan with different scenarios. So this is a formal process, but it's very important because this is the basis for the laboratories to sort of make resources available for the machine more than I think for detector and physics people are more free. For the machine, your boss needs to agree that you do something at some level. It's not 100% strict. So this is a very important process this year for us. And this LDG created panels to provide input. And one of the panels is on muon colliders or muon beams. So these are the Mendel panel members, in case you want to contact any of them. And we plan to do this with the community to hopefully in May, when we are just trying to fix the date, to actually see what are the challenges, what do we think needs to be demonstrated within 5 years to be able to continue with a big demonstrator. What is the physics case that motivates that we should really go for the muon collider in spite of the fact that it will have challenges? And okay, so that's going on. We will have, for those more interested in technical details, a workshop on the testing opportunities actually starting tomorrow. And the goal there is to identify where could we use some proton facility, for example, to add something without increasing the cost of the test facility too much. Okay, this report should be ready in September and it goes to council. And then hopefully we get full support. We get some support sort of from the laboratories and people do what they like to do and things, but it's not yet huge resources officialized, except for CERN that has put in 2 million per year. So we have a budget, five staff equivalents, so full-time equivalents of staff, and about six fellows and some students. Not all of them are yet there, but this is the budget that I have. Okay, there's a similar process on the detector technologies, but there it's technologies, not integrated facilities, where Nadia is sort of trying to make the contact, and you see there is a number of panels. And in the end, we believe that we are probably not so far off other people's requests. And then there is the US SNOMES process, the P5. And there we submitted a number of proposals for white papers on the physics and the detector and the accelerator. We can really sense a growing interest in this. And this is the list so that you see that. And we try to find a way to work with the US. It's a little difficult because people are officially not entitled to work with us now. They have to wait until the process is over and the P5 has decided. But always, you can do a little bit independently and universities can do what they like. And so okay. But it's a little difficult to get that formally without too much trouble. And then the physics potential, there was a paper that we had submitted to SNOMAS. And then there were actually many other papers that had been submitted by other groups to SNOMAS. So that's really, really good and encouraging. So we think there's a value in going, I mean, I think it's the only realistic 10 TV option, muon collider, as far as I can see. So we have to go there and see if it really works. But I don't see, I think plasma is way, 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 well, it's excluded as far as I can judge now. So in conclusion, it's a unique promising option. We need to really explore the physics case to make a strong, we have the support. And we never looked beyond 3TV sufficiently thoroughly. And we have to address the feasibility. So a great challenge, but a great opportunity. There's this workshop starting tomorrow. We have a web page, which is evolving. Now I have somebody who is actually looking at that and helping. And we have mailing lists to which you can register. So you have to go to this web page here, and then you look for muon collider, and then they will pop up. And basically any institute is connected in a way that you can subscribe for these mailing lists. And then you will be informed about the meetings that we have. We have regular meetings on the detector and on the physics potential, and also on the accelerator for the design. So every week or every other week, depending on this. Okay, so that's it. Thanks.
Thank you very much for this very interesting talk.
Yeah, and then for those people that were interested in the cost, because we had this discussion before, here you have a full table that I prepared for the European strategy update with the parameters of power and cost of the different projects. So you can just look at all of these numbers. And those were less relevant. I thought I had the one with the MOU, yeah. And for those that are more senior, who are interested in the memorandum of cooperation, we know that this is not possible for the S to sign because I have to wait for P5. I don't know for Canadian institutes, for example, if it's a possibility. I
It's not clear. I mean, it's not clear how, I mean, it depends on how, there's been a long discussion about Canada. Well, I think we should stop recording. Anyway.